Roadmen, in today's podcast, I'm going to talk to Sebastian Weber. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Roadman, welcome back, Roadman. It's another Roadman cycling podcast. Yes, it is. You know it is because you hit that download button and you hit that play button and you had the big goofy picture of me smiling. So you're well aware that you haven't clicked on Joe Rogan's baldy head. Roadman, I've got an exciting episode for you today. It's Sebastian Weber. Sebastian Weber is a name that works behind the scenes, but he's the reason behind some of the biggest victories in pro cycling. At the tender, fresh-faced age of 28, Sebastian was head of sports science at T-Mobile. And look, he went on and he had a career where he worked with most of the best teams in cycling: High Road, Columbia, HTC, Katusha, Lotto, Cannondale. The lad knows everything there is to know from a cycling and performance point of view. He's one of the greatest minds in coaching. He's also the founder of Inside Software, which is poised to become the new de facto threshold testing in our industry. It's an emerging software and it's super exciting. But above all that, Sebastian is a super nice guy. And I was lucky enough that he joined me on our upcoming Roadman Virtual Summit. If you haven't heard about the Roadman Virtual Summit, really, what have you been doing with your life and where have you been? It's tick, tick, ticking down. It's the 8th of December. It's coming up. So I hope you've registered. Please share it into those groups. Share it. Spam everyone. It's free. Spam everyone. My goal is to just get this out to as many people as we can because it's going to be awesome. Tackling performance from 30 different angles. And there's guests of the caliber of Sebastian Weber on it. So today, for the interview, I want to play an extract from that summit with Sebastian. So if you want to hear all the rest of the interviews from the summit, it's roadmansummit.com, and that's going to get you access to 30 interviews over 2 days on the 8th and the 9th of December, just in time for a run-up to Christmas. So we'll give you all that info, and you're going to be like, oh shit, I'm missing all this stuff. Now I need to put it on my Santa list. Guys, you know, I say it every day. The podcast is funded by user generosity, and we work heavily off that concept of reciprocity. I'm doing something good for you guys, putting it out to the world, hoping something good will come back, and this will become financially sustainable. So if you want to support the podcast, buy me the price of a beer once a month. How you do that's over on Patreon. It's patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. That'll let you buy me a beer once a month to say thanks. And in return, I'm going to knock you out a secret podcast once a month with all my inside tips, and you're going to get access to this every single day as you have been doing. Folks, I'm not going to push this one off any longer. Let me introduce you to Sebastian Weber.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited about this interview. You're somebody who I've definitely followed your work, and I think it's fair to say you've shaped a lot of the way we coach as modern coaches these days, especially with some of your new software that's getting so popular, which we're going to touch on a little bit as we go. But as everyone can see, Sebastian is quite fresh-faced looking, and if somebody didn't know, if they've just been following, you know, your academic work or your papers through the years, they might have assumed you were like a 65-year-old man, but you got into the sport quite young.
Yeah, so, I studied sports science and molecular human biology, and obviously you're relatively young when you start studying. But then I started coaching via the entry, so to speak, through performance testing. So I started performance testing with amateurs and also professional cyclists in, what was that, 2001. And then in 2005, I worked with, at this time, the team Wiesenhof. So it was, I think, today would be called Pro Continental. This time it was GS2 team. and some individual athletes. And then as a coach in the highest ranks at what is now the World Tour and what had been the Pro Tour, I started at the end of 2006 when I was about 28 years old.
Was that difficult to go into? Because a lot of your stuff is quite challenging, the status quo. Was it difficult to go into a sport that's dominated by tradition rather than science at such a young age?
Yeah, so it was difficult, especially about, you know, communicating, getting people's commitment and buy-in. It was helpful that actually this was the very reason how I got into the sport. So what happened was some people will remember in 2006, there was this Fuentes scandal. And basically at the German T-Mobile team, they fired Jan Ulrich and the whole management. And, you know, basically everything was kind of renewed. And the new general manager, Bob Stapleton, was looking for somebody who had, you know, at this time, it might sound weird, but who had a good idea on using power meters for coaching. And at this time it was kind of, yeah, you use it for training sometimes, but you don't like it. But of course you don't put it on the race bike, right? Never. Just too heavy and you don't need it in the race, right? So this was the time back then. So they looked for somebody who had a very good understanding on how to utilize power meter and power meter data in training and racing, and would not have, you know, a background, let's say, as a medical doctor coming from Italy or something similar, if you know what I mean, right? So somebody with a clean background and some new, fresh ideas. So, yeah, it was difficult, and it sometimes still is in terms of challenging, but there was also a very strong support from, you know, the team management and the team director. So the general manager and the team director, OF Aldag, you know, supported the stuff really, really well. So
and to give us an idea on timeline then, was that before like the publication of Andrew Cogan's Training and Racing with a Power Meter?
Yes.
So it was real.
Several years before. I don't know. I don't know exactly when it was published, because I did never read it, actually.
Have you not read it? No. That's interesting.
But I know that at this time, I was talking to Uli from SRM, right? So you know, to give you an idea, so I lived in Cologne, and SRM is about half an hour drive from Cologne West. So I was at Uli's private house. Uli Schober is the inventor and founder of the SRM systems, the real first power meter. So I always talk to Uli about that he should write a book, how to train with that thing, because a lot of people are interested in it, but didn't really know how to utilize it. And Uli always said, I don't have time to do this, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, this is why I know, that the book from Cogan and, I don't know, Frieder, I think it was, came
Hunter,
out.
Hunter Allen, was it?
Several years later, after I was pitching the idea to Uli to write a book about how to train with power. So therefore, I know it, I don't know the year, but I think it has been a couple of years later.
And for listeners, SRM was super expensive back in the day. We're in this era now of very affordable power meters with lots of competition in the market. But 2004, I remember I was an undergraduate student. And that year, I was just getting into cycling, and I was starting to look around, and I was looking for mentors, and I was trying to absorb as much knowledge as I could. And I came across the power meter, and I was quite academic, but I didn't have a lot of money. So I said, look, I need this. I need to get a way to get this. So I had to forge like a bank application loan. I said I needed a car to go to university and spent it all on an SRM. And I think it was €3,000 at the time for the SRM.
Right. Yeah. So talking about the old times or the good old days, so to speak. So I purchased a used Look Max 1, if you've ever seen that. That is hub-based power meter. I purchased it, but never really worked that well. And then in my summer holidays from school, I worked 6 weeks on a construction area carrying around radiators and stuff to own the money to buy a used SRM of Woolly. This is how I started.
So I suppose we have these defining eras and everything. If anyone's religious, it's obviously like before Christ, after Christ. Like it seems like in coaching, it's before the power meter, after the power meter. Do you see it as that pivotal a point in the coaching evolution?
Kind of, maybe, yes. Yeah, it definitely changed the whole environment and the whole landscape of coaching.
And are we still moving the needle since then? Like, how are you seeing coaching from then until now? Is the needle moving every single year, or are we getting a little bit stagnant?
Very honest, I think it's frustrating about the stagnation there. Because look, it's true that the power meter changed the landscape of coaching, right? In terms of everybody uses power and instead of heart rate and stuff like that, right? But think about how you use a power meter. Well, you're still looking at some kind of proxy for an anaerobic threshold or maximum lactate steady state. These days we call it FTP, which just indicates that's a functional version of the scientific term, right? And then we still work with percentages of that. And this goes back to the mid 70s. So to be honest, no, there's no improvement really there. We have the technology, but how we use it, it's frustrating, stagnating, because it's still the very, very old concept. Hey, there's some kind of domain and intensity, which you can call a threshold. And then we just take, you know, we use this to drive our decisions in training. And that's super old school.
And it's funny because I think amateurs tuning into this kind of have this allure of magic around pro cycling and what the pros are doing. And across this summit, it's definitely been a lifting of that veil of secrecy. And you see that behind the curtain, it's actually not that crazy, you know, what was the dude, Rocky IV, Ivan Drago in the lab. There's not this crazy stuff going on behind the curtain. That it's not that
more like
more
punching
advanced.
The pigs, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it depends, right? It depends. I think some things are really advanced in training and in nutrition and in racing and in pacing. But that does not mean that should not kind of paint you the picture that just because some stuff is really advanced, that, you know, the main 90% is still about getting the fundamentals right, right? So that, of course, doesn't change and maybe didn't change and maybe it will never change.
So how hands-on are you these days, or what's your current role?
So I'm mostly working for, you know, a project called Insight, which is a human, which is maybe the only software to analyze metabolic human physiological performance in all kinds of sports. I still coach one rider. I still coach one professional rider. That's what I've left over, so to speak. From
Would
my
we know
coaching.
Who it is?
It's Tom Scoins from Trek Segafredo.
Okay, cool. He's moving well.
And so, yeah, I'm mainly working for Insight in all different areas, mostly developing of features and consulting and developing testing concepts for different teams, federations. So I work a lot with swimming recently, with canoeing, skiing, Formula One. So all different, so performance analytics and training and how to use physiological metrics and how to define needed physiological metrics like benchmarks for certain competition performances and how to utilize this in coaching and testing in all different sports. That's my main.
I suppose that's a good segue for us to chat a little bit about Insight, because I think a lot of our listeners won't have heard of it. It's getting a little bit of popularity, but it's still more towards the very elite end of the sport that are using. And I know you're a big entrepreneur as well, and I'm sure you're looking to get that trickle down to all levels of the sport, because I think the bits I've played around with, it has an applicability to everyone, and arguably more so to guys at the lower level of the sport. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
What do you want to know? it is, you can imagine it as like this one, you know, giant algorithm or one giant calculation or simulation engine, which is, you know, basically creates something like you might want to call a physiological avatar of an athlete. So it's looking at all different aspects of performance, you know, aerobic power, anaerobic or more precise glycolytic power, recovery possibilities, fuel utilization in terms of fat and carbohydrates, ability of an athlete, which is really, really important, especially in cycling, as we're talking about cycling here, ability of an athlete to recover. So how fast can an athlete recover at a certain intensity? How quickly he or she accumulates fatigue? And then if you would take it to other sports, it's also looking at like economy. So, you know, energy cost for movement and body composition. And you can, you know, and maybe the most important piece of it, because it kind of builds this avatar for you. And now what it enables you to do, it allows you to find out which knob, so to speak, you need to turn. Like you know, what should I change in order to create a certain outcome? So how much do I invest? How much do I get out of it, right? Let's say I want to change my FTP. I want to change my carbohydrate combustion, my fat max, my three-minute power. You can basically virtually turn those knobs in the software and find out, you know, should I decrease my body weight? Should I increase my muscle mass? Should I increase my VO2 max? Like, you know, you can get these questions answered. And that, I think, what makes it so powerful.
And I think it's an interesting tool because I work a lot with amateur athletes, and a lot of the athletes coming in, they're guys who are balancing, their life is very multifactorial. They're like, they're balancing work, family, relationships with cycling. And cycling isn't the main part of their day, but they still have a piece of their identity where they like to be an athlete. But a big job is an initial consultation when you're sitting down and you're looking at assessing their current ability, their available training time, and matching that with their goals. And you're saying, look, this goal that you have, like, you know, if you have a goal to do a sub 9-hour Ironman, like with the available training time you have, this is not going to be a possible goal. But I think your software does a great job of showing like what are those possible times with their current testing at the moment, where if you take somebody with an FTP test, you know, it's not giving us much insight into potentially what speed they could travel and their, you know, breakdown of how much fats they'll need and how much carbs they'll need to fuel that endeavor. But when you look at inside, you can kind of say like, unless we shift your fat burning capacity, you're not going to be able to take in enough carbohydrates to fuel this performance on that day.
Right. Yeah. So you could definitely, a lot of people, especially like in Ironman or in Gran Fondo races or marathon running, you're using it especially for this, you know, fueling and pacing thing to find out, you know, how much more do you need to, and it, you know, how much more do you basically, for example, you need to be able to take in terms of carbohydrate intake to achieve, to not run out of fuel before the finish line, or how much you would need to change your metabolism to, you know, be able to reach a finish line with a certain intensity, right? This is a question that it answers for you.
So I had one of the Mitchell Scott performance guys on. He was saying they're playing around with pairing different sugars and they're getting carbohydrate absorption up to about 120 grams per hour at the moment, which is pretty cool. Now, some riders will have gastro issues at that high of a number. But if there's an amateur athlete watching that and their target is unachievable based on the inside software at the moment, where it's saying to them, look, you need to be processing 180, 190 grams of carbs per hour. How can they shift that fat curve and sort of burning a higher fuel, a higher fat demand in their fueling?
Right. So that's, you know, excellent question. And the question behind that is basically, how is your fat and carbohydrate combustion regulated? Right. And of course, we could go down into the biochemistry of it and look at the enzymes that regulate it and, you know, talk about PDH and these kind of stuff. But maybe to have a more practical understanding, it's like basically you have, let's say, your aerobic metabolism. Let's say you call your, you know, very simplified speaking, you have your aerobic engine, which you need to fuel with either carbohydrates or fatty acids, right? So you have your engine and you need to fuel it with either the one or the other. It's like a hybrid system, so to speak, right? And so basically how you can envision it for yourself, especially as an amateur, also as professional, but for a practical application, how you can look at it is that there's almost like a competition between those two fuels, the fat and the carbohydrates. Right. And what it basically is and what it always is in biochemistry, or often it's like, you know, again, simplified saying, it depends on who is the bigger dog in the fight. So if your carbohydrate metabolism is very well developed, right? If you are, let's say, a sprinter type, so you are the guy who can produce a lot of energy in the anaerobic way, right? utilize a lot of carbohydrate to get a lot of energy from the anaerobic glycolytic metabolic pathway, then just because you decide to do a 4-hour easy going ride, this doesn't go away, right? So this ability of your muscle will still be there. And so your muscles will still process a lot of carbohydrates.
So even if you go out on empty that day, the bigger dog still says, we're going to burn whatever leftover carbs we have in the muscle.
Well, not whatever left over, but let's say it's more dominant, right? It is more dominant. And the easiest and the best sentence to remember is, when you burn carbohydrates and you produce lactate, this pushes out the fat out of the metabolism. And let me give one practical example why intuitively everybody knows that. Let's say you do a hard interval training, let's say 6x4 minutes, right? And this is a little bit above threshold and you accumulate lactate, and let's say you do 6 minutes recovery in between. So you start every 10 minutes, a very typical, very simple training program. You're doing the 6 minutes of recovery in between, but obviously to recover. So what you're doing is you are combusting the lactate in the 6 minutes, which you are accumulated in the 4 minutes before, right? In the on phase.
Yeah.
And because if you ask somebody, hey, do you think you burn fat during the 6 minutes recovery? Then a lot of people will answer you intuitively, no, I, even though that is maybe my fat burning zone, maybe I ride at 100 or 200 watts or 150, 200 watts, even though that normally would be my fat burning zone, I'm not burning a lot of fat because I'm a recover to burn the lactate, which I just accumulated, right? So whenever there's lactate, and this is like the takeaway message, whenever there's a high lactate concentration, your muscle will use the lactate because it's a much, much more efficient fuel. It will use the lactate over the fatty acids.
Okay? So it'll fuel off the lactate.
Yes, of course. Like why we are sitting here and chatting, you know, our heart, for example, of our most powerful muscle is primarily running on lactate as a fuel source.
That's really interesting.
And let me complete this maybe with an interesting or important piece for, you know, your daily training. Let's say you go out, let's say on a 4-hour ride and say, yeah, you know, today I'm doing a good fat burning ride, right? This is my aim for the training. And even though if you have the intensity right, so even if you know precisely if you need to ride at 160 or 180 or 200 watts or whatsoever, right? Let's imagine you go out in a little group ride, and every 10 to 15 minutes, you do a sprint. Like in Germany here, we do sprints to the next sign of the next, you know, city center sign, something like city limit sign, something like that. And imagine, so every 10 to 2 minutes, you do that. And you accumulate in the sprint, let's say you do a long sprint or a harder effort, right? And you accumulate 6 or 8 millimoles of lactate. It pushes out the fat for the next 5 to 15 minutes. So if you do this 4 times per hour, what was intended to be a fat burning ride is actually not really a fat burning ride anymore.
It's the Roadman intermission. Roadman, this is the moment when you just press pause and you think to yourself, oh shit, I'm getting a lot of value out of this podcast every day, and especially today's episode, I'm getting a lot of value and I'd like to pay a little bit back. Roadman, I'd encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh, and that's the way you can pay a little bit back and make sure this podcast sticks around so other people can get value in the future. Okay, let's get back to Sebastian.
So it really needs to be a disciplined fat burning ride. Even the surge is up a little hill. You know, that right. Could potentially push you out of fat burning zone for 5-10 minutes.
Potentially. And here, I'm sorry to say, there is, so to speak, where the general recommendation ends. Because when you are an Ironman type of guy and your glycolytic capacity, or what is called VLMX, like the counterpart for the VO2max, when this is relatively low, so you're not really good, so to speak, at accumulating lactate, then you can do a 30-second effort and not a lot is happening to your lactate levels, right? So, yeah. So the amount you push out the fat is rather low. If you are more like a sprinter type of guy and you do this, well, then sorry, then you potentially, you know, accumulate a lot of lactate and it will take you a long time to get rid of it. So therefore you block your fat or you inhibit your fat combustion for a pretty long time.
And what's happening to your glycogen stores in this period?
Well, it depends on how much glucose you take, but in general, you will use glycogen for that, of course, right?
So if we take a typical protocol that a lot of amateurs will do, where on an a super easy fat burning or recovery ride, they'll go with no breakfast. On maybe an endurance ride, they'll go with a lower carb breakfast. On an interval day, they'll go with a higher carb breakfast. Is that something you would advocate?
That is very difficult. I mean, basically the science says, yeah, in general, if you go with lower carbohydrate supplementation or carbohydrate content, for example, leave out the breakfast, or just have just have proteins for breakfast, then you can elevate your fat combustion rate. You go to a higher fat combustion rate earlier, and there's even some science that indicates that there is a potential to have a better aerobic adaptation to your training, so the training benefit can be higher. However, most of the studies, 90% of the studies, quantitatively speaking, only look at the transcription level. So that's something that's often overlooked. Like, you know, all the studies showing, or most of the studies showing, that the effect only happens on the transcription level. So basically, genes are activated that should potentially increase your performance. But when you look at the studies, really looking at the performance outcome from doing this, you know, low carb training, then the effect gets really small to not existing. And what is important here is that the studies that you're looking at are looking for statistics. They're looking for a change. And let's say, you know, the average adaptation was better with or without breakfast, or with high carb or low carb or whatsoever. But what many cyclists are looking to are the professionals, right? You see Ineos is doing it not. Jumbo is doing it not, whatsoever, right? So you look at what are the big guns doing in terms, right? And what is important to note is that when you look at those studies, for example, there are very great examples of, there's, for example, one very popular one where they do a 100K time trial and they do spikes in performance in the 100K and do it with a low carb and a high carb diet. And you can see that in average, it doesn't work. In average, the high fat, low carb diet is hampering performance tremendously for the full distance, for the harder efforts, whatever. But there are a few outliers. So long story short, for some athletes, it works. And what I would like listeners to understand is that in the professional world, in professional cycling or in all other professional sports, we don't care about the average. We don't care if a low carb diet works in average, right? When I was coaching a professional World Tour team with 28 or 26 riders, I don't care if this works for every rider. The only thing I'm interested in, if it works for my one guy who can win the race. If he gains 2% with it, then I'm going to do it. And then you are going to read it in the news about it one day. And you go, oh, I have to do it, right? But that's not me. That doesn't mean that it works for you, right? It could be that this is, again, in this study with the 100-kilometer time trial, I don't know, there's maybe 20 subjects, and for 18, it doesn't work. So the general recommendation, not knowing you as an athlete, not knowing your physiological profile, the general recommendation will be, better be careful. But there are one or two guys where it really helps.
So in a fictitious world where you decide to expand your coaching stable by 100% and you take on a fictitious second athlete, and it's one of our viewers and he's a time-crunched guy, sort of training 8 to 12 hours a week, what's your key sort of process for getting to understand the physiology of this rider when he comes into you?
Well, for me, it should all start with a proper assessment. And don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to advertise, you know, on my own project or the own tools here. Whatever it is, it should just start with a very, very precise assessment of, you know, at HCC, I always say, what are the limiters? What are the limiting factors? I would always sit down with an athlete, for example, when there was a new rider coming in. And that's the same. That's exactly the same for a professional rider as it is for a time-crunched amateur age group or whatsoever, right? It starts with an assessment, understanding what are your limiting factors? What is keeping you away to performing better for whatever your goal is? And sometimes that's training. Sometimes what you say, it's training the gut, it's nutrition. Sometimes it's just being able to stay in a better aero position, right? It is just being more efficient in riding in the pack, whatsoever. When it comes to physiology, it comes down to understand the physiology, how your body, so to speak, ticks, right? Are you, you know, do you have a high VO2 max? Yes or no? If not, well, there's tremendous room for improvement, right? Do you have a high VLA max? Yes or no? Is there room for improvement based on your goal? Yes or no? Are you a little bit overweight? Is there potential room for improvement in loose body weight? Yes or no? Right? All these questions is there, which you need to tackle and answer in order to have the best strategy. I, you know, maybe think about not as a training program, but think about it as a strategy. Because training program for most people feels like, in cycling, it feels like, yeah, training program means you need to be out on the bike riding. But strategy could involve doing whatever flexibility training for your aero position or other things, right?
So I think it's a great point as well, where you talk about, you know, cycling being more than just the physiology of the bike. And this is something that permeates, a message that permeates the entire summit from all of the World Tour guys, that the physiology is one part of it. We've seen all these outliers through the years. You've worked with High Road, and Mark Cavendish was there at High Road, I think, when you were there. Like, his early performance tests indicated he almost shouldn't be a professional cyclist. They were so bad. Yet we're looking back and potentially the end of his career now as maybe one of the most decorated cyclists of all time. And I think a lot of amateurs watching this, and especially in the new Zwift culture, where they think you can sit inside on a virtual e-game and then all of a sudden plug yourself into a race environment come March, and you're somehow magically going to inherit all the skills that you need to ride in the bunch, to shelter, to feed, to change clothes, to all the other dynamics that happen within a peloton.
Well, yeah, so there's a Mark Cavendish story about his test as Hyrule was a little bit different, that indicated that this is time of the year he wasn't fit, and not in general not fit. But especially what I learned also from experience with the teams, and I think this is a very similar point, is when we were recruiting, for example, when we were looking at, you know, youngsters to become professionals, we were looking at not so much about the physiology, but from a team perspective, you would try to find somebody who's highly successful, but not yet reached his limits in terms of his physiology. Right, so it doesn't really help if you say, oh, this guy is doing quite okay in the under 23 or quite good in the under 23, but he's already at 85 VO2 max and already at 6% body fat and has been in the wind tunnel 5 times. Then you have to ask, well, then where the heck do you want to improve him, right? So what you're looking for is somebody where you say, yeah, he's doing very good based on what he has, and now if you throw all the tools at him in terms of better training, better nutrition, better aerodynamics, better everything, you know, then it's going to take off.
Yeah, I have a term I call that coaching age. When I get a client that comes into Roadman Cycling and you chat to them and they're like, yeah, so I've been racing for 10 years. I've had 10 different coaches and, you know, I've been to the wind tunnel. I've been to like 15 different nutritionists. You're kind of like, oh, I'm not sure what I can do for this guy.
Yeah.
But if a guy's coming from another sport and it's like, you know, it's blank slate, it's year one, even if they're 30, 32 years of age, you're like, oh, there's still quite a lot of room for improvement here.
Right.
Ketones is something that's coming up quite often across a lot of people at the moment. And I think some people are just unsure how to use it. And again, it's back to your point of, it almost doesn't matter what works for the masses. Is that one specific rider, in this case, Roglic, getting a super benefit from it, and that's why everyone else now thinks it's fashionable? I know I spoke to two of the guys on Mitchell and Scott yesterday, and they said they were looking to test it again this winter, but they still hadn't pulled the trigger and confirmed they were going to use it. Have you played around with them, or what's your thoughts on them?
Yeah, so we have used ketones, the version of it before it was commercially available. So when one package was still $800, we played around it, and obviously because of the price tag, on, you know, in a smaller scale, and only during exercise. And you know, the latest research indicates that it might not be as beneficial. It, you know, can actually inhibit performance in some cases when you use it during exercise. So during exercise is a little bit specific. It's not that straightforward. And you know, where it's getting more popular is using it as a recovery supplement, right? And there, as a recovery supplement, it seems to work quite well, and also for you know, a broader audience, so to speak.
So what's going on with that? Why is this, what's the mechanism behind why it's useful as a recovery strategy?
I would not talk about this, I guess.
Okay, but it's something you're still actively kind of playing around with and looking at.
Right.
So moving on to more broadly, stepping away from ketones, moving on to broadly the fueling requirements for an athlete. I think your typical Joe going out at the weekend, the gel companies want him hammering in, you know, a gel every 20 minutes, whether he's on his group ride on a Saturday or he's on his Zwift session on a Tuesday. Do you have any take on fueling strategies?
Well, it highly depends on your goals. And on, I think it depends on three things. So what is your goal? What is your actually need of carbohydrates? So how much carbohydrate you really burn, right? And then think about the broader picture in terms of the recovery. So what I mean here is that we, you know, that we should think about not the actual training. We should think about the next trainings to come. So for example, when you go out on a Sunday and you have two more days recovery before the next session, then you know, there's plenty of time and there's not really a need to go fueling during the ride, right? You can just empty, so to speak, your glycogen stores because you have 48 hours to the next ride. No problem at all, right? But when it's Saturday and you have a long ride on the next day, then you should think about fueling during the ride because you think about the next session.
And is there an argument for if you fueled on that day, your performance would have been at X percent higher, and then the adaptation to that training would have been that little bit higher as well?
It's not that straightforward. In general, you know, we talked about the low carbohydrate, higher fat diet and how it potentially could improve adaptations, right? The idea is basically, so now I have to talk a little bit technically here. So technically, and that might be for some people might be a little bit surprising, but technically your beta oxidation, so the process of beta oxidation is anaerobic. It might sound strange, but you look it up in biochemistry, it's anaerobic. There's basically only one single metabolic step in the whole body, in every cell, where oxygen is processed. This is in the mitochondria. So why I'm bringing this up is because the adaptation of the mitochondria, so what ultimately is your last bottleneck in processing oxygen and producing energy or power output aerobically, the ultimate bottleneck is how much mitochondria you have, how active it is, how much, you know, how much ATP it can process. And for the mitochondria, it doesn't really matter, so to speak, if you have a higher oxygen requirement because you burn additional fat, which needs additional oxygen, or because you go 20 watts harder because you push a little bit harder. It just triggers a higher oxygen demand. This is, by the way, also you can find a lot of literature telling you that high intense training increases fat combustion, because the only thing you're doing, you're increasing VO2 max, and therefore you're increasing your ability to use fat as a fuel because it needs additional energy and therefore additional oxygen. So the answer here is that, yeah, potentially going a little bit lower in your carbohydrates, burning more fat, so to speak, artificially, so to speak, increases your oxygen demand and therefore potentially increases your adaptation, right? That's a little bit simple way you might think of it as a car. Think about the fuel combustion or your mileage, in a car. When you drive it really economic, or when you whatever put the air conditioning on and the DVD player and whatever, it uses additional fuel without, you know, the engine needs to work harder, so to speak, right? Or without you going faster. And that's a little bit the same here. So higher fat combustion needs more oxygen and therefore potentially triggers better aerobic adaptation.
That's really interesting. There's a really interesting book. It's called The One Thing by Gary Kelleher. And he has this idea almost like Archimedes' lever, that if you have a big enough lever, you can move the world. And he has this idea with his daily routine where he looks at what's the one thing that if I solve this problem, every other problem ceases to become relevant in my entire life. So to take that that metaphor from Gary Kelleher and bring it across to us in this conversation in cycling, if you were speaking to the audience directly as you are now, and you were looking to identify that one thing, that Archimedes lever to take them from where they are to their goals, what would that one thing be? That's a question for you.
Yeah, obviously the answer is it depends, right?
Scientists always give that answer.
Yeah, no. So obviously the answer is it depends. For a road cyclist, you mean?
Yeah, road cyclist.
Yeah, it depends.
We'll make it more specific. We'll say a road cyclist who's carrying maybe 3 kilograms and wants to. He doesn't narrow for a time trial at the moment, and he wants to go a little bit faster.
So look, let's come up with some use cases here, right? Let's take your cyclist who is already in the sport for 3, 4, 5 years and whatever, has the ability to train, let's say, 10 hours per week, just to make up one example.
Yeah.
So you have a limit on your time, and you're using this limit already for the last 1, 2, 3, 4 years. The sad truth is that your adaptation for your VO2 max, so to change your, like, from a physiological point of view, right? Your possibility to vastly change your VO2 max without changing or without increasing your weekly commitment to training are slim. There's only so much you can do, right? There's not so much more you can do in terms of increasing your aerobic power. If it would be different, like, this is why I bring this up, it's your biggest lever that you have, right? Your biggest lever that you have is just cranking up this VO2 max to skyrocket, and you will ride much, much faster. That's very, very simple. But the problem is, in this example, we just maxed out our training time already. So the possible additional improvements you will see in VO2 max are relatively slim. So in this case, the biggest lever that you have as a road cyclist is your VLMX, is your glycolytic system. One of the very early studies that we did, we looked at the differences in VO2 max and VLMX in professionals and amateurs. And the difference in VO2 max is only 20%. If you think about it, and a good amateur is 60, 65, whatsoever, maybe, and a professional is 75 to 85. So that's approximately 20%. The difference in VLMX is like 200%.
Whoa.
So there you have your biggest lever and the importance of VLMX.
So just break down VLMX for someone who's not familiar.
Oh, sorry. So VO2 max is a proxy for, it's basically maximum oxygen consumption. And why it exists, like, normally we can say, okay, we don't care. We don't care how much oxygen you take up. The reason is very simple. There's no technology, and it would not be very feasible to stick like a probe sensor into your mitochondria while you're riding your bike and measure aerobic energy turnover. But what we know, what science knows, is that your aerobic energy turnover is absolutely proportional to the oxygen uptake rate. Hence, you use VO2 max because you can measure it. And VLMX, so to speak, is a counterpart of your anaerobic metabolism. Because when it's also not possible to stick a probe sensor into the cytosol, where this is where in the muscle cell where anaerobic metabolism happens, and measure glycolytic energy turnover. But the rate of lactate production is, again, absolutely proportional to the rate of glycolytic energy production. So now I can just go to Amazon or eBay or something and buy a handheld lactate analyzer and measure it. That's why we use it. So VLMX is like your glycolytic counterpart, so to speak. What VO2 max is for your maximum aerobic performance or power, VLMX is for your glycolytic part. Okay, and the differences in VLMX between amateurs and professionals is twofold. And so, physiologically speaking, this would be, you know, maybe your biggest lever. And the importance of it, the effect it has on your performance, increases with your VO2 max. So when you're just starting, don't care about it. But if you are this guy, just we just make up this example, you're already riding for a couple of years and you maxed out your weekly time commitment, there might be a bit of potential. Your other case, which you're trying to bring up, the time trialist, maybe your biggest lever is aerodynamics.
Yeah.
Maybe just train how you train, but put your, you know, put your trainer in front of the mirror and have your girlfriend use a lipstick and outline your, you know, your frontal area or your side area and tuck in and practice this position, or use a Leomo device to understand, you know, if you're able to keep your head down and shoulders up. Maybe this is the biggest potential to improve performance in a time trial.
Sebastian Weber, I really enjoyed that chat. Thanks very much for taking the time.
I thank you for having me.
Cheers,
it was great.
Roadman, before you go, I've got an important announcement to make, because over 2 days, and the 8th and 9th of December, I'm going to speak with 30 of the world's leading fitness experts, and I want you to join me free of charge from the comfort of your own home. This is the first ever Roadman Virtual Performance Summit, where I'm aiming to bring together the best minds in fitness, and they're going to share with me their secrets for biohacking your physiology, melting away body fat, and smashing your cycling goals. Would you like to learn their secrets? It's easy. All you have to do is register for your free ticket over at www.roadmansummit.com/free. That's www.roadmansummit.com/free. The link is in the bio.